song. Is it?
Hello, and welcome to Whose Song Is It Anyway? I'm Dr. Hayley Bosher, and for this special season of the podcast, focusing on women in the music industry, I'll be your host.
So, hi Vic. Thanks so much for coming on the Whose Song Is It Anyway podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you're doing a PhD, and I've been there, so I can imagine, on top of everything else, you're a very busy woman. So, can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do in the music industry?
Well, thank you very much for asking me to participate. It's a real privilege. And yes, so my name is Vic Bain. I've worked in various parts, maybe most parts of the music industry over the past 25 years. For the past 4 years, I've been really focused on diversity in music. And that sort of takes three main strands, really. So you mentioned my PhD. I do a lot of research in this area because it's all about good quality evidence. And then I do a lot of sort of not-for-profit charity work. And that involves running an organization I set up called the F-List for Music, as well as my work with the Independent Society of Musicians. And then I sort of squeeze in some paid work to pay for it all, doing various bits of business or diversity consulting. Really, my background for many years has been with membership organizations. I was previously chief exec of what was then called the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers and Authors. So yeah, that's more, you know, more running music businesses. So that wasn't very pithy, but that's essentially what I do.
There's so much to unpack there. Also, for more recent listeners, that's the now called the Ivers Academy, if they're wondering what's the, I don't even know the
Basker.
Previous name.
Yeah.
Basker. Yeah, much, much longer. So they've rebranded, but they're still awesome. Okay, so much to unpick there. But what's great is that you, having all that breadth of experience, probably you found informs your research now, do you know what I mean? You've kind of like, you've seen the music industry from different angles, which is so valuable. So let's begin with the F-List. Can you, I assume that lots of our listeners, given the topic, do know about the F-List, but let's assume that some people might not. Can you tell us a bit about what that is and also why you started it?
Yes, so the F-List Music Directory is essentially a directory of female and gender expansive musicians who are based in the UK. We have nearly 6,000 listings now, and women can go and create their own listing. And that means that they are visible, they are findable to the music industry so that they can get commissioned, they can get booked, they can find management, musicians can find them, fans can find them, radio DJs searching for new talent, you know, they can just be found. And that visibility, I think, is so important, because I think I was just a bit tired of reading radio, of newspaper interviews or hearing radio interviews of mainly festival promoters saying, well, you know, we can't book women because we can't find any, they're not there. Women don't play guitars, women don't play in bands, you know, all of this sort of rubbish. And so I created this directory to make the women visible. And hey, you know, lo and behold, there's probably two or three times as many female musicians out there, but the ones who've created listings, yeah, there's nearly 6,000 now.
Amazing. And if someone wants to, if they're listening and they're like, I want to get on the list, what do they do?
Look at the website, flistmusic.uk, and create a free listing. You know, just take a few minutes. They can put all of their contact details up, all of their socials. They can embed up to 5 different types of music feeds. They can categorize themselves from skill set, you know, whether they're an instrumentalist, a producer, a performer. And different genres, different instruments, there's dozens of those, or location, so that they're, you know, there's a really sophisticated search function. Yeah, but it's just free, so they can join the community.
I love it. Thank you. You know what's really interesting? Lots of our work crosses over. And actually, I created basically a parallel directory called World IP Women because of the exact same thing. I was so fed up of going to conferences in law, because obviously my background is law, and there being not only with men on the panels, but only men in the room. I'd sometimes be the only woman. And I've got like all these hilarious, well, they're not hilarious, but you've got to laugh, like pictures on my phone of me sat in the back of a conference and just a sea of white male heads. And it's just like, this is absurd. And after a while, it just really started to grind at me. And I went up, I've even like confronted people, not confrontationally, but been like, excuse me, why don't you have any women on this panel? Why are there no women here? And they said the exact same thing. Oh, we don't know any women in law. We don't know any women in intellectual property. Give over. I work at university. I know that 60% of law candidates are women. So if they're not coming through, there's a problem. And also that's just because there obviously are, we'll get onto the issues. But anyway, so we had a really similar parallel experience where then I was like, fine, I'll just create a directory. Here's a big long list of thousands of women doing this job, all different variations of this job, all across the world. Don't give me that shit. Do you know what I mean? It's like, there are women doing it. So I completely appreciate your motivation because I heard the same thing. And I think that, like you said, visibility is so important and it's just so inarguable. They're like, well, there are women doing this, so you need to make a bigger effort. So let's get into some of the reasons why, beyond the fact that people think that there aren't any women, we might be seeing, because I think there's parallels, like I just said, you know, we see lots of women study law, but not a lot of women being partners of law firms, for instance. And obviously in the music industry, there's really similar trajectory of like women and girls interested in doing music at schools and then coming through, the numbers just drop off. So in your research and your experience, how have you found what is what I'm saying true? And what do you think some of the reasons are for that?
Yes, it's absolutely true. So in every sector, as you've, you know, described, we see what's, you know, what's called the vertical hierarchy. In music, we see, you know, that that educational pipeline where it's more girls than boys who study GCSE music. It's about exactly equal for A levels, although until just the past two years, for many years, girls were getting better grades at A level music than boys. It's just about evened up now. And at university level, it's a mixed picture depending on the discipline of music, but overall, including every music related subject, including audio engineering and business and performance, up until 2018 was the last time I had data, 44% of music graduates were women. So slightly less than half, but still, you know, a good amount, and it is increasing every year. And yet when it comes to professionally working, certainly as a musician, the women just disappear. Office of National Statistics data shows that over the past 10 or 12 years, it's about 25% of those who are reporting that their primary income is as a professional musician, about 25% are women. And when it comes to being signed by labels, signed by publishing companies, well, it's 20% of music label rosters are women, 14% of writers. So it's, you know, we can see this vertical hierarchy. So the more status that a position has, the fewer women are participating in that. Why do we see that? I guess it's complicated. There are many reasons. I think a lot of it goes back to gendered social roles. So women are funneled into or encouraged to follow certain career paths. Men are encouraged to, you know, go in other directions. But, you know, what we see, and again, this is in every sector, but we see the roles that women do are not as well paid, not as well regarded, don't have the same status. So women predominate in music therapy, in music teaching, that, you know, those sorts of nurturing, caring roles, which nobody seems to value. And the men are encouraged to, you know, be rock and roll and get on the road and be, you know, be professional musicians, specialize in, you know, using music technology and so on. And we have similar parallels in the business side, but yeah, it's more extreme with musicians.
Yeah. Okay. So there are kind of two main things that you've touched on, like the pay gap, I'm summarizing, and gender roles. And I guess those are, like you said, there's lots of issues and we don't have all day, so we actually cannot cover them all. But I think those are two key and quite interesting things to talk about. And I've just read this book called Everyday Sexism. Have you read it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Devastating.
Laura Bates.
I cried. It was so, and it's nothing as a woman when you hear these stories from these women, and probably it's been the same experience for you maybe when you've been interviewing women for your PhD, like, and talking to people, it's not surprising, a lot of the things, but it is shocking. And it was just the over, but I would really recommend it to anyone who's listening, because it, I love the way she supports everything she says with evidence, and she's also telling the stories of women. But one thing that was the saddest part for me was the stories of the children, 7-year-old girls being like, no, women can't be pilots because they're not as clever as boys. That's a boy's job. And you're just like, why? Why have we done this? Why have we done this to these girls? Like, and it's so insidious. It's so ingrained in them consciously and subconsciously from the minute they're born that this gender role exists even today. And it's just, honestly, it was devastating. I fully cried when I listened to that book. So for the gender roling that leads to women, it's not just like women not choosing that job, but also society not inviting that woman into that role as well, isn't it? It's like a push and a pull situation. So I don't know if you can expand a little bit on that topic from your research and what you found around gender roling in music.
Well, I'm quite a way through my data collection phase of my PhD. So I've done 35 interviews with women so far. I've got another 15 lined up. And they're real deep dives. They're like 2-hour dives into their career pathways. And it's, you know, it's just very interesting, the power of families and parents and you know, social upbringing, education. Enlightened teachers is a real help. If you don't have that, it's more difficult. It's, you know, so if women want to do things which are, you know, seen as masculine, especially working in studios or producing their own music or being anything other than, you know, the beautiful singer, then women have a real hard time overcoming those stereotypes or, you know, or composing and writing music, which is, you know, really, really seen as having masculine qualities. So, you know, there's a lot of stereotyping, a lot of sexism, a lot of discrimination to overcome to succeed in those roles. And what I'm really finding quite interesting is the women who are really successful and incredible musicians invariably are having to step outside the label system and do it themselves. And they are, you know, weighing up the pros and cons of that, but are you certainly in the group that I'm speaking with randomly as well, you know, people who I think, you know, are not talking to each other, are making the decision to be independent because the sexism and the control and the prejudice within the label system is unacceptable to them. And that's really important because I published some research at the end of 2019 called Counting the Music Industry, where I looked at, you know, who were the labels investing in, who were the music publishing companies investing in, you know, significant amount of money and support. And it wasn't many women, you know, and that's really important because they can, you know, these labels are sort of selling themselves as the research and artistic development engines of the music industry, and yet they're unacceptable environments to many women who are then choosing to, you know, step outside of that system and do it themselves to retain control. These are women who've played on number one albums, toured around the world, had significant success, won all sorts of awards, and yet have said, this is not going to work for me. I need to, you know, maybe take a financial hit, but do it myself. So there's massive barriers to women's career progression.
Yeah, to the point where they're like, I'm not even going to play this game. I'm going to go and make my own arena over here. Yeah, that's really, really interesting insight. So thinking about those women that you're sort of describing now, if you had to think of, like, are there any common threads or themes in their kind of personality? What I'm trying to think about is when we say things like, you know, gender norms are a problem and like heteronormative issues, it's so difficult, I think, it's quite a lofty concept, and it's difficult to be like, there's no, oh, if you do these three steps, everything will be fine. So I'm wondering if these women who have succeeded and have overcome to a certain extent some of these challenges have a common kind of trait, whether it's like rebelling against the system, or how do they feel empowered beyond the gender norm? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I've got a good while yet to go on my PhD analysis. You know, I need to spend a good 6 months full time analysing, you know, to really be able to pull out all of the threads. But it seems to me so far that having a nice middle class upbringing helps.
It just does,
you know, to have that good music education, to have a good stable, you know, support, some money to help you through those initial few years, maybe some confidence. So that seems to be a thing which I need to explore a lot more. You know, having a supportive partner, if you were in a relationship, having somebody who supports you, because, you know, I have spoken to a few women who, I mean, they literally had to get divorced, you know,
wow.
And if their home environment wasn't supportive, especially if they choose to have children. You know, lots of women I'm speaking to are like, children, it's career suicide. So that's a pretty major issue for women in the business as well as performers. You know, and then lots of women, you know, I do ask them, well, you know, how does one succeed in the music industry? And everybody does say, well, hard work, persistence, tenacity, you know, all of these qualities. But as Laura Bates would say in another one of her books, which is brilliant, which is Don't Fix the Women. Fix the system. You know, you can be as tenacious as you want, but if you don't have economic resources or, you know, support at home, you know, you're still not going to be able to break down some of those barriers. So most of the women I'm speaking to have achieved success and been very successful, but I'm also speaking to women who've struggled, and maybe their career hasn't, you know, been quite what they wanted it to be or what it should have been, because the, you know, the barriers in their personal lives have been too much. There's also been a couple of women who have told me that they're too traumatized to speak with me, which has been really, really sad. And a remarkable number of my interviewees are undergoing therapy. A remarkable number, I have to say, you know, even hugely successful award-winning people. So it's, and I have to say, in all, you know, all of my interviews as well, they're all absolutely confidential.
Of course.
So nobody's, you know, I'll talk about the experiences in general, but nobody will be identifiable. So, you know, I'm being told about a lot of very, yeah, horrifying experiences, lots involving outright misogyny and sexual harassment of varying degrees of severity, as well as a lot of what I call financial abuse as well. So it's quite the powerful process.
I can imagine. I think it's really important to recognize what you said about because when I was thinking of like, what are these traits, I'm trying to understand the picture a bit about how to overcome the gender norm as a challenge, but also obviously there are a barrage of challenges. And so when you say coming from a middle class family with support at home is so important to recognize, because as you said, even if you were all of those things, the most hardworking woman in the country, you might have more barriers than someone who actually it's also working hard, but maybe not as hard as you, but they have financial backing, or, you know, started the race ahead of you. And so I think it's a really important point that you've made there. When I'm talking about these traits, I'm just trying to understand if there are any hidden solutions in there of like how, and people, that's what people tend to ask, isn't it? Like, what, how do you become, like you said, how do you get successful in the music industry? But there's all the barriers you start with. So your ethical, cultural, gender, sexuality, all of economic circumstances. And then, as you said, especially as a woman in the music industry, or say as a trans person or a queer person, you might then be faced with traumatic experiences in the music industry that then become another barrier or even a setback. One of the interviewees on this podcast season talks about an experience of sexual assault, which led to her not leaving the house for a number of years. And obviously that affected her life and her well-being, but obviously also her career. So that then, as you said, becomes another barrier. And I think it's really eye-opening what you said about the fact that so many of your interviewees are going through therapy because of the trauma that can be the music industry. So yeah, I'm just still processing what you said. I don't even have a question. I'm like, this is horrific.
I mean, I'm definitely looking at the enablers as well. You know, my research question is looking at women's careers in the music industry, but looking at the enablers as well as the barriers. So I am really, you know, exploring with people, well, what has helped?
Mm.
And another more positive thing, which is emerging very strongly, in fact, is there are powerful gatekeepers and mentors out there. And for many women in music, those people are men, because it's not all men. And we have some really good guys out there who are using their position of power and influence and experience to really help women. So that's a joy to know, and you know, is a real, oh, you know, it's a silver lining in what can sometimes feel like a very dark cloud. So that, you know, that I would, yeah, definitely, you know, give a big shout out to all of the good guys out there who are you know, doing the right thing for the right reasons. Well, in fact, and the right reasons are to have a more creative music industry. You know, creativity is in, you know, so many places. And if you are discriminating against whole swathes of society, then you're cutting yourself off from more creativity. More creativity means better songs being written and produced and performed, and more exciting music and more diverse lineups, and more, at the end of the day, more music sales, more music streaming, more ticket sales. You know, it's a win-win. So for people in the music industry to have these prejudices and discriminate, especially against women, doesn't make business sense.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't make this. It's 50% of the world. Like, you're just, because also it's, when you say like more success and creativity, there's so many layers to that, isn't there? There's like the song itself, and then there's also like how many people that song will resonate with if it's made by somebody of the gender of half the world. I love that. That's really encouraging to hear about the allies. I'm wondering if there are people, because do you know what's really interesting? When I look at the data on who listens to this podcast, in the first two seasons, it was about 50-50, but sometimes majority female over male, and then a small percentage of non-binary or people who didn't specify their gender. And this season so far, there's been more people who've said that they are male listening rather than female, which is so encouraging. I know, I'm really happy about it. So thank you so much to the listeners who are listening. So for those people in particular, what makes a good ally, do you think? Or how do they, you know, I think just some encouraging words basically around being a good ally, what that might look like. Because if some people, I think, are keen to listen because they're not sure, like, what should I be doing? Like, I'm on your team, what should I do?
Well, I think, you know, for music companies, they can start by looking at the data within their own organization and seeing if there are any gaps. Now we are getting, we're making strides within the workforce, but perhaps more on the entry level positions than at management ranks. So they're, you know, in most music businesses, they need to be focusing on retaining and developing their female and gender expansive people within the workforce, going up the ranks vertically. But for most music businesses which have artistic rosters, could be agents, management companies, publishers, record labels, or if they're, you know, event programming, they simply need to sign and book more women. Because that's where the huge, huge gap is. You know, if 80% of signed artists are men, 86% of signed writers, certainly in 2019, they need to do something about that. That's, you know, absolutely ridiculous. And as well as, you know, having a moan about those statistics, I am a very solution orientated person. And that's why I set up the F-List, because there is a solution. You want to know where female talent is? Have a look there. And I tell you, the music is incredible.
Yeah, great. I think that's really, because it's good to have some practical kind of steps as well. You touched on something else that I want to ask you about, which is the pay gap. And I don't know if you want to share, if you've got any kind of nuggets and statistics off the top of your head, and the experience that you've gauged from the women that you've interviewed around pay. But also my main question, which I'm really keen to ask you and also everyone, is because sometimes people say to me, there isn't a pay gap, and I'm too busy being angry to formulate a coherent answer. So what do you say when people say there is, if someone says, well, there isn't a pay gap, it's disputed? What's your response to that?
It's disputed. All of the, there's so much research which you know, delves into this. The gender pay gap reports that under the Equalities Act, the government has to, you know, publicise all of the companies that employ over 250 people. You know, so we all know about that. There's only about a dozen companies in the music industry are that big, being an industry of micro businesses, but you know, there are 12, and I've been tracking them and analyzing every company which falls in that bracket. And the, you know, and it's true, things are getting slightly better. So we're at kind of about 15 or 16% that all of the men in those organizations are, compared to all of the women, no matter what role they do, the men are in higher paying jobs. Back to what I was talking about, that the roles that men do are, you know, considered more valuable. So there is a pay gap on the hourly rate still, which is higher than the national average. The really interesting thing about those pay gaps is it also, you know, it also reveals the vertical hierarchy. So so it'll tell you in quartiles how many men or women are in each of those organizations. And there's this hierarchy, women in the lower paying roles. But the bonus pay gaps, oh my goodness me, are absolutely eye-watering. Eye-watering. So if you look at, you know, organizations such as AEG and Live Nation, it's more men than women are paid bonuses. And, you know, and in some organizations, in some years, the men are paid 60% more.
Wow.
So the evidence is there that, you know, and then people say, oh, but it's not for the same jobs and blah, 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 you know, but who is saying that, you know, who's deciding that one role is more valuable than another? You know, and women who specialize in marketing and PR and human resources, or is, you know, executive assistants, those roles are not deemed to be as valuable as finance or tech. Who decides that? You know, we do as a society. So there's that evidence with the government pay reporting, but lots and lots of economic transactions in the music industry is totally cloaked and hidden. You know, it's the vast majority of people working in music will either be self-employed or work for micro businesses, and they don't have to report in that way. And I've experienced pay discrimination in my career. And most of the women I'm speaking to in my PhD interviews are reporting this, including situations like, well, you know, definitely as musicians, finding out somehow that, you know, doing festival gigs and so on, that they're being paid a lot less than the male bands and musicians at a similar level. But even things as extreme as women playing in bands and finding out that the deal they are on from the record label is worth less than the men in the same band. Finding that out, you know? And then would they complain about it? So what? So they're, you know, so they're treated less valuably. So that there really needs to be a lot more transparency, because when there is transparency, like there is on these, you know, really big companies, then all of a sudden the companies have to take note, because they know it damages their reputation. They might not care, and clearly they don't morally, but reputationally, maybe it'll encourage them to go in the right direction. So I would definitely like to see the pay gap reporting requirement to be significantly lowered, as it is in some other countries, to maybe, you know, 50 or 20, I think would probably be more useful in music. But also, how about having some transparency around record deals? That would help. We got to think of other ways of making, you know, of making this data. I mean, I can remember asking PRS for Music years ago. Oh, you know, we know that, I think at the time it was like 15% of their over 100,000 members, only 15% at that time. I think it's gone up to maybe 17 or 18% now of their members are women. I said, so what percentage of the monies that are collected, what percentage of that goes to women? Because I was interested to see whether it matched, you know, or whether the women were, you know, if they were only at the time 15%, were they only being paid 10% of the income? Or was it higher? You know, I suspected it was lower in, you know, in that women's works weren't being performed and exploited to the same level. And I was told categorically that that information was too sensitive. Which indicated to me that, you know, maybe there was a problem. So, you know, it would be interesting for record labels to say, okay, so, you know, 20% of our rosters are women, you know, and yeah, what percentage of the income are, you know,
and
are women earning?
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so if women were on lesser deals, yeah, how much money was being invested in, you know, in terms of upfront deals? Information like that, we could really see how, you know, how much of a structural problem there is, because I'm talking to individuals who are, you know, who are telling me about the, you know, the financial discrimination that they have faced, and, you know, that they just find out about, and, you know, sometimes unintentionally find out about. But and definitely a lot of awareness from women in the business side that, you know, they're doing a job at a certain level and it's not being translated to the job title or the pay that they are being awarded. So they're aware that they're doing a job which has significantly more responsibility than they are being rewarded. But can they do anything about it? Not a chance. Not a chat, you know, because they'll be sacked, they'll be pushed out, and probably given an NDA on the way out.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's just so frustrating. And also the two things that we've talked about, the gender rolling and the gender norms and the pay gap, there's research that shows that these are almost actually connected directly. I read also in that, because I read it the other day, so all the data from that book's fresh in my mind, but she talked about a study where they did a double-blind randomized CV that they sent out to all these universities across the country for the same job, and they mislabeled. So the exact same CV, and on some of them they put a man's name typically, and then on some of them put typically a female name. And the universities gave feedback that the male CVs were more competent and offered them all a higher starting salary. And it's the same CV. So there's, you know, this thing of like, okay, just pay women more, just hire more women. In some ways, obviously first steps. But I worry that that's like fixing the symptom, not the cause. Because I've also seen research where they corrected a pay gap, like in that way, in a company. I think it was in Sweden. And they just matched everybody. They were like, well, fine, we'll just do it. But then within 3 years, the pay gap was back because they hadn't addressed the underlying issues that were causing the pay gap in the first place.
Interesting. I haven't come across that one. I'd love to know what research paper that is. But, you know, I'm aware of other research which shows the same, certainly around race and ethnicity as well. And, you know, foreign sounding names on CVs will, you know, definitely face the same levels of discrimination, and how much harder it is for Black and ethnic minority people to be, you know, even get as far as being offered interviews. So there's a whole, you know, we haven't really explored the intersectional impact as well. So I'm speaking to trans women, lesbian women, Black and ethnic minority women, disabled women as well, to really, you know, explore the multiplying impact of other levels of discrimination too. But yeah, that's really fascinating that those, you know, that the pay gap reemerged, you know, because who is doing the assessing? Who is making the decisions about merit and who deserves reward and promotions? And until you really start to, you know, be able to make people aware of their own stereotypes and biases in those assessment processes, then yes, absolutely. That's, you know, that's what it's all about. So we all, every single one of us in society, but in our music industry, needs to be checking their own biases, going through self-awareness processes and training. It's going to be a hard job, but everybody needs to participate in that.
Absolutely. And we all have them, unconscious bias, even all the time. You know, it's something that we, as you said, everyone, it's not like all the men must do this or all the straight people must do this or all the white people must do this. Like everybody has these unconscious bias, especially when we're in a patriarchal society. That one thing that really I find brings it home for me is when you start looking at timelines of things and you're like, it's only been like, no woman was allowed to do my job 100 years ago. It's not been that long since, like, when you look at, like, the timeline of, like, you know, the whole planet and humans on the planet, and then, like, the teeny weeny percentage of time that women were even allowed to step on a stage or, you know, permitted. And even then, the data sometimes seems more positive than it is. So, you know, we've had this 100 years of women in law thing. But when you look into it, like, okay, they were allowed a law degree or they were allowed to be working a law firm, but they weren't doing any law. They were making cups of tea. Like, they weren't allowed to go to court for years afterwards because they had to. That was the thing of like, fine, we'll let women in. Fine, we'll have one woman. Fine, we'll, you know, we'll hire a Black person. And then, but not actually let them do anything because they haven't worked on the biases and breaking down the stereotypes and all that kind of thing. So I think when we say there's a lot of work to be done, it's because we're still in it. You know, it's not like, oh, everything's fine now. There's still, like, in the grand scheme of things, we're sort of scratching the surface of this stuff, aren't we?
Yeah, I call it, we're just emerging from 1,000 years of musical patriarchy. When I give presentations to students and other groups, it's really easy to find, you know, a picture of 1,000 white composers from history, you know, if you want to question that we've had a musical patriarchy, here's the visual image, thousands and thousands of, you know, dead white men, which form our canon. And that informs us. And we're still transitioning. We're still pushing our way out of that. And those, you know, biases and prejudices are still present. You're really right. I mean, I can remember one man in music saying to me, but what are you complaining about? You've had the vote for 100 years and yay. But, you know, I mean, I've still got, you know, and I do, I'm sort of alert for examples of sexism, you know, statements and so on, which, you know, men in music, you know, maybe founders of publishing companies and so on have come out with over the years to show, you know, that sexism and sexist thoughts are influencing behavior still in music. Yeah, all of the, oh, well, women, you know, they blame the women. Women just aren't as good at making music as men. They're not as creative. They're not as ambitious. They don't like playing instruments. They do, you know, this, that, and the other. All of these things, every time I hear one of those or read one of those on social media, I add it to my long, long list of, you know, why are we seeing these statistics in music? Oh, it's the women, it's the women's fault in some way. Mm. But of course it's absolutely not. It's structural.
I find with those comments what's really telling is how contradictory they are. So it's like the woman is blamed for having a baby or not having a baby, or getting married or not getting married, or, you know, it for playing the guitar but then not playing it well. And, you know, because also one of the things about the lineups that people have justified why you might not have a headline female act is, oh, they don't have the fans. But that's because they're not given the opportunity, and they're not given the, you're cutting them off way before the point where you can't headline them. So I think that's really, like you said, really important to highlight that it's still there in thought. And the fact that people say it out loud means that not only are they thinking it, they think it's socially acceptable still.
Things I've been told by, you know, quite well, men I've known quite a long time in music. They come out with all sorts of, oh, well, they're just not as good at making music as men, you know, which is just shocking. And actually, my retort to that one is, there's been some really interesting and, you know, I find quite funny, but very serious research done by a professor at INSEAD, Professor Noah Askin, and he and his team analysed 2 million tracks from Spotify, the Spotify database, going back to the 1950s, but all the way through to quite recently, 2 million tracks, and they found that women write more creative music. By creative, I mean more unique. You know, they had algorithms analyzing the music for uniqueness, novelty, more creative songs. They found women were writing more creative songs. So, so whichever way you look at it, the sexist responses are, yeah, we need to challenge that with good research and data, and start to turn, you know, this sort of sexist juggernaut around, stop it and turn it around.
I think it's really interesting, and we could talk about, you know, the value of data is so important for pointing to things that we already know to be true, but we want to validate it and also overcome, you know, oh, well, that's just one person's experience. And you're like, well, actually, here's 50 people and here's the common themes. You know, you're building a repertoire of referable evidence that we can point to. And I think that's so important to be able to, like you said, the things that need to change. Then we have this kind of, it's almost frustrating in a way because you kind of wish we didn't need it. But at the same time, it's really helpful for overcoming those unconscious bias and preconceived ideas where people say to me, you know, things like, oh, I work with loads of women in the music industry. So that, you know, they almost don't believe you that it's only 20% coming through and things like this. And you're like, but that's your individual experience. And there's research that shows when they showed films to men with like 35 or 40% women actors in the film and asked them to rate what they thought the percentage of the genders were in the film. And they thought it was like 75% or something. I'm not remembering the numbers correctly, but it was definitely that it was less than 50% and they rated it over 50%. And when it was 50%, they rated it majority female. Because we're so trained, like you said, for 1,000 years to see a lot of white men everywhere, that when you see a few women or a few people of color, your human brain is like, oh, there's loads of women. and it's just not, it's categorically not true.
It's the phenomenon of the token. So especially if a minority group constitutes less than 15% of a particular group, they will be tokenized and they will become more visible. Mm-hmm. They're more noticeable because there's fewer of them. So they, you know, it has this, you know, this sort of opposite effect. And what, you know, was the one thing you might have heard, somebody might have said this to you before, but one thing I'm often told when I say, you know, there's discrimination and inequality in music, especially against women, I'm told, but what about Adele? What about it's the what about Adele phenomenon? And I call her a super token because she is so visible. She's uber visible in the music industry, and her incredible success is supposed to compensate for all of the discrimination and harassment that just about every other woman in music has faced. So, you know, equivalent Beyonce in America. What about Beyonce? But yeah, I can't tell you the number of times I've, you know, heard that, read that, had that said to me. What about Adele?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's almost, and I don't even know if those people who think that are just genuinely, you know, lacking in knowledge and education about it, because this is such a cringy reference, but, and I don't watch Love Island, but there was a famous clip from a Love Island episode years ago where Theresa May was it Theresa? We had a female prime minister, and the which I can't remember because I don't know when the show was, but the clip was one of the contestants arguing with one of the women that there was no sexism in the UK because we had a female prime minister. And it's the same concept, isn't it? It's like, but there's one, so there can't be.
Exactly.
It's like, it's the same. That's really interesting, isn't it? That like, if you can point to one, then that somehow invalidates the experience of thousands of other women. It's really interesting. So it's super token. I like that. It's a really good way of
super token
illustrating that point. Thank you. So is there anything else you wanted to talk about or say about your research or your experience or anything else that you wanted to add that we haven't covered?
Well, I just want to say that there are solutions and we can do something about this and we can be more aware. I think, you know, we have made great strides. The first time I did diversity research in music was like 2011. You know, in all of my campaigning and various things since then, what I've seen is more acceptance from the music industry that there is an issue, and you know, a greater desire to want to do something about it. So you know, springing up are dozens and dozens of initiatives, not for profits, you know, all sorts of charities, projects going on that are looking at, you know, different aspects and wanting to do something to help. So that's the, you know, is the good news. You know, loads of people have given support in different ways to the FList project, but we still have a way to go. We can't keep our foot off the accelerator. The music industry really needs to do more work with these incredibly passionate campaigners more. To really, you know, I will not be satisfied until labels are 50-50. They're signed artists, you know, and the women up the management levels too. So I'm just gonna keep going until we get there.
Great. Well, you're doing a great job, and we really appreciate you. And like you said, it is, and I've had that experience talking to people as well, that it is getting better over time, and I feel a sense of momentum. In the last year or so in particular, I don't know, it's because it's also like aligns a lot with society, although in some ways the music industry, you know, like the pay gap is more worse than in other sectors. But then in other ways, the music industry can be so innovative, and there are, as you say, there's a lot of women actually here who in the music industry who are absolutely fed up with this nonsense and extremely motivated to make things better for everyone. And that's great. So I'm really glad that you said that. And it's really nice to end on a more positive note. And that's great for people listening as well, because you can get involved in these campaigns. You can follow these groups. You can join, as we said, for the male allies, you can support these campaigners, and yeah, there's lots going on to get involved with, which is great, and to put the pressure on, as you said, to focus on these solutions. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more about your research, and good luck with the rest of your PhD, because I know PhD is really hard work. And honestly, when I started my PhD, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I don't know that I would have agreed to do it if I had done. But at the same time, I was really glad I did it. It was such an amazing experience. And I don't know if it's been the same for you, especially because you do it part time, don't you?
Yeah, I've done. So I'm in my fourth year part time, and juggling all of my different, you know, strands of my work is such a challenge. And I've decided actually from talking with my supervisors, from September, I'm going to do a year full time of study, because I want to do all of the analysis and writing up with as much focus as possible. So I'm just sorting out my economics to enable me to do that, so I can really, you know, if not fully completed, hopefully I'll be, you know, substantially near the end, because I'm really impatient now to, you know, I've got to write 100,000 words. I really, you know, I need some time to do that.
It's also,
I am loving it.
Yeah, and actually I think that's a brilliant idea, if it's possible, because I mean it's not possible for everyone, and I'm not suggesting for a minute that everyone should do a PhD, because it really is not for everybody. But if you are doing it, one of the greatest things I found about the experience was that ability to just like deep dive into a subject and think about it every day for me, it was for 3 years straight. And for some people, that sounds like hell. That's what I mean. Like for some people, they were absolutely not. For me, it was like a special interest where I obsessed over this topic for years. And actually, that's such a privilege, because when else in life would you really get the opportunity to do that? And I think that process in itself is real kind of just amazing experience, actually. Which for me, my actual PhD research, I'm not even that really bothered about it anymore. I've like moved beyond it. But whereas with yours, maybe because you're doing it at a different stage in your career where you've like figured out something that you want to focus on and then a problem you want to help solve. Whereas I was just straight out of law degree, didn't really know what to do with my life and sort of did it. So it was more, the most value I took from the PhD experience was actually the experience of doing the PhD more than the actual research, if that makes sense. So I don't expect that to be the same for you. Yeah.
Although I am really, you know, it's a privilege to be able to go back to school in your 50s, you know, and study. Although my mum says, oh, I thought you would do that. You all, you know, when I was asked at school, when I was at school age, what did I want to do? It was basically stay at school. So, you know, to sort of, you know, work for 25 years and then go back to studying like this has been brilliant. And, you know, and a real challenge, I have to say, you know, to get that academic brain in gear. But I've never read so much in my life. I am totally obsessed by this subject. I love it. It is my favorite thing in the world. So that, you know, that is a pleasure, because I feel like I'm understanding human nature and behavior in a, you know, in a really fascinating way. So yes, I can't imagine how, you know, not being totally obsessed or in love with your PhD research question. That would be terrible. I'm very lucky in that this is my passion. I mean, yeah, economically, it's been, you know, a terrible decision, really, you know, to do crazy thing to do in your 50s. But it's what makes me tick and get out of bed every morning. And, you know, and the really understanding how fantastic a research process and how rigorous it is. Every step of the way, everything you have to go through to construct your PhD is a revelation. It's like, oh, that's why they're so well regarded. You know, because it's tough. It's really tough. But it is a privilege as well. So
yeah. Well, I second you on that. I mean, it's an amazing experience. And I love what you said about it helps you to understand this is what I mean about the specific, because basically I did my whole PhD on like Section 17 of the Copyright Designs and Patents Act. Who cares? But that's not the bit. I'm obsessed with copyright, and I always think of this quote from The Alchemist, where he says, "If you want to understand the whole world, you can study a grain of sand." And that's how I feel about the PhD. Not that I understand the whole world by any means, obviously, but that it gives you a deeper understanding of your subject and humans somehow. Because even if you're not doing, I didn't do qualitative like interviews, but because you study something so deeply and you're thinking and you're analyzing, and like you said, everything's constructed. It just, that for me is like the most amazing opportunity that a PhD can give you. But anyway, sorry, this has just turned into me loving and being so excited about your PhD with you. Yeah, and just research in general. So my final question that I've asked everyone is to, if you could please share with us a favorite female music maker and maybe tell us a little bit about why. And I know that's a lot of pressure because there are so many to choose from. So it doesn't have to be your absolute favorite, just a favorite.
Yeah, and there are so many, aren't there? So, you know, I've had various names, you know, jumping into my head, but I have to admit, and it makes me laugh every time I put her music on. I think one of my guilty pleasures is listening to Grimes. electronic music, and I'm laughing, you know, because she's quite a bit younger than me. It's, you know, I'm definitely, you know, not her target age group, but I just think she's brilliant. You know, all of her, you know, this image she's constructed around herself, but also the fact that she's such a badass producer. I think that's what I love. She's, you know, I've watched lots of interviews with her, you know, claiming the technology, claiming the role of producer very fiercely, you know, and she writes such good melodies, and then she's doing everything. I just think she's amazing. So I, you know, yeah, I've got quite a few of her albums. I mean, I will admit I've got thousands of CDs still. I'm very wedded to the physical format. But in my car, I've usually got one or two Grimes albums in my car. And yeah, she's just brilliant to drive along to. And yeah, she's my guilty pleasure.
I love it. I don't even know if that counts as a guilty pleasure. I think it's just a pleasure. So thank you so much, Vic. I will link to any resources that we mentioned in the podcast bio. So please check that out and follow Vic's work. And we look forward to hearing more about your PhD, and good luck with that final year. Keep us updated. Thanks so much for coming to us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe.